So this week we're coming live from the Science Museum in London.
Yay!
Hurrah! We've been through all the old tapey bits and we're here surrounded by this modern studio equipment.
Thanks for organising access to this place, Sarah. It is so cool.
Organising?
Yeah, for them leaving that window open for us.
Oh, yeah, because the front door's stuck. The curator said, yeah, so...
You'd think they'd fix that, really.
Yeah, anyway, we've been getting into the roots of electronic sound design. I've been listening up on my musique concrète.
Does that explain the clothes?
Experimental, eh? Voilà.
So, experimental electronic sound. Back in the day, it involved actually making the equipment. So pioneers like Daphne Oram needed a mix of musical skills with electronic engineering, complicated mathematics.
And now it's just menu buttons.
You're right. We're very lucky now. I don't think you should touch any of this or click on that.
I could do this all day. What does this thing do?
Oh, do you know, this beats sellotaping all those bits of tape I found together. It's much quicker, isn't it?
You did what? Are you sure we're allowed to actually be here?
We love you, Delia Derbyshire! Hello, I'm Sarah.
And I'm Fiona.
And welcome to the Audio Drama Production Podcast.
This week we're talking all about experimental audio.
Ooh. Mm. Well, yeah, what is experimental audio, Fiona? For those who might not know.
That's a very good question, Sarah. Well, I suppose standard audio drama, I suppose you could go back to normal radio plays, couldn't you, where you've got dialogue and most of the acting's quite natural, and you've got natural sort of diegetic noises, so noises that actually come from things. So you pick up a gun and it makes a picking up a gun noise.
Go on, do your best gun. Yes, awesome.
Yeah. So that was probably, yeah. Or someone opens a door and you get the sort of noise. Uh-huh. Whereas maybe experimental audio, there's a whole spectrum, really, isn't it, of... Do you go with stylized acting or...
A bit of melodrama, you mean?
Oh, yes!
Overacting. I don't know anyone who does that.
I couldn't imagine anyone who does that. yeah, so, you know, we're all experimenting in our own ways, really, aren't we?
Absolutely.
And I suppose non-diegetic noises and sounds. So, you know, someone walks into a room and you have a... kind of...
Ooh.
Well, you know, please insert your own sound.
Yes, amazing.
Which so, obviously yes. The room is not making, but it's adding to that atmosphere and that...
An imagined stylized version, yes.
Mm.
Exciting. So you were lucky enough to speak to someone who's quite an expert in this field, isn't that right?
Absolutely, yes. Stevie K. Farnaby. He goes under the name of Skiffle for some of his experimental soundscapes. And the one you've really got to listen to is the Electric Grasshopper out there. It's this amazing soundscape where, in fact, the dialogue is cut almost entirely. So it is purely telling a story through the use of sounds that he's made and music. It's really extraordinary. So, yeah, I guess for you might not want to go quite that far with your... audio drama, but it's always interesting, isn't it?
Well, also, you know, extend your personal skills as to making something that's not perhaps linear, not perhaps, you know, the normal thing that's being released, and having a good old play with all your knobs and bits and pieces.
Absolutely. It's a very good thing to do quite regularly to get to know your door. You know, there are so many nowadays, so many sound effects and things. So yes, very good advice.
Well, exciting.
Yeah. So here's the interview that I did with Stevie K. Farnaby. If you want more links to his work, then we're putting them up on the site. Do have a listen. Hello. So I've got the pleasure of speaking to Stevie K. Farnaby here.
Hello.
I wanted to ask to interview you, actually, because at the moment in this episode, we're talking about experimental music and experimental audio drama. And you did the brilliant Electric Grasshopper EP.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. If you haven't heard it, we'll put a link to it on the website. But as it's described, a unique and innovative form of storytelling that combines elements of music and drama to create an unnerving, disturbing tale of alien invasion. First of all, what were your influences for this piece? Do you want to tell us a bit about how you came to make it?
Yeah, sure. I'm from a music production background anyway. I used to work out of a recording studio, and I also used to do like live sound out of the northeast of England. And I've always had an interest in radio plays, and in fact, I've actually been producing radio plays for about 10 years now. And I wanted to try and do something different that maybe not very many people have done before. So in terms of inspiration, I was sort of heavily inspired by the likes of bands like, Jean-Michel Jarre, Kraftwerk, The Orb, Enigma, and of course the Radiophonic Workshop.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came up with this notion of, certainly when you listen to bands like The Orb did a piece of music, I think it was early 80s that it came out, and it was basically the longest piece of music ever to be released as a single because it was over 45 minutes long. And it was called Blue Room, and it was supposed to be the sound effects or certainly the background sort of ambience of Hangar 18, at Area 51, where they're supposed to take the alien bodies. And I'm thinking, wow, that's fascinating, you know. And it actually is quite a disturbing piece of audio when you listen to it, but it's not actually telling a story. It doesn't have a start, middle and finish. And so I wanted to say, well, can you actually tell a story but without dialogue, just with pure sound effects? Because I've been doing sound design as well for, you know, 15, 20 years, something like that, something I've had a real sort of interesting for some time. Mm. So I thought, yeah, why don't we? Why don't we do it, you know? And that's how it all came about. Very, very difficult to do, to be honest with you. So because I had to kind of put it together with a musical structure as well. So because I wanted it to still be recognisable as a musical piece and not sound like it was like random musical tones. It had to sort of come together and actually sound like a finished piece. I suppose it's kind of, you know, when you listen to jazz music, you get some great stuff like the Dixieland stuff. It's fantastic, great melodies, great bass lines, great rhythm, just brilliant stuff. And then you get that jazz music that sounds really, really random, like they're just basically it's just people running up and down scales without even, you know, none of it seems to fit together, you know, and that's not what I wanted. I wanted something that sounded like it fit together as well. So, I mean, they were my basic inspiration for the piece. And it was a lot of fun to do,
yeah,
in all honesty.
I mean, it does sound, like you say, it sounds like a piece of music and like a drama as well, and you've got the narrative going on. In track 3, The Aftermath, you do a commentary about some of the things that you did, actually, which is definitely worth, it's fascinating to listen to. And in that, you mentioned you had 25 audio tracks. Is that, how did you kind of manage them? And
okay, 25. I mean, to be honest with you, that's fairly low for me, to be honest with you. The last episode of Escape from New York, the audio drama that I did, that was on over 500 tracks.
Really?
Yeah. So basically, I had the reason for putting things onto separate tracks, of course, is controllability.
Yeah.
If you've got something that's slightly just too low in the mix, you can just tweak that track and it's done and it's finished for the entire timeline, if that makes sense, yeah.
Yeah.
So, 25 isn't that much. I suppose the way to manage it is within your production software is to label each track really well.
Do you colour them different colours and all that kind of thing? Or?
No, I just use a lot of text-based stuff. I mean, when I was working in the studios, for example, I was working at a big mixing desk.
Yeah.
One of the things we used to do was, I mean, the studio I was working at, we had a 24-track Studer Revox reel-to-reel tape machine,
mm-hmm.
which was kind of, even by sort of like mid-80s, that was kind of considered a bit old school, if that makes sense. But
yeah.
But it really was a beautiful piece of equipment. And, I mean, you were talking close to £500,000 worth of tape deck. So the quality, as you can imagine, was absolutely second to none.
Yeah.
And it was all valve-based as well, so it had a beautiful sort of warmth to the recording. But we had that running through a 32-channel fully automated mixing desk. And so what we used to do is we used to put little pieces of white electrician's tape across, put a strip of that across the bottom of the mixing desk, and then we'd just write on
with
a felt tip pen, you know, what was on each track. I've kind of gotten used to doing that over the years anyway. It's like, it's something that you have to do, particularly when you're talking about the bigger mixes, the more complex mixes, you know. Escape from New York, for example, was an absolute nightmare to keep a track of all of them. You know, what was going on in each part?
I can imagine if you have that many going on. Yeah,
yeah.
That's some processing as well. It didn't kind of break your computer.
No. Well, what I did was my production software is Sonar, and the way that the production software works is it only loads in a certain section of the audio that you're currently working on.
Ah, right.
And then when you move across the timeline, it preloads the next section. It's not like you've got the entire mix in RAM at the same time, because that really would have made my computer have a complete meltdown. You press the wrong button, you know. So yeah, that's kind of how you sort of keep a track of things, but you've really got to do it well, though. You've got lots of description within the text, the track descriptions. You know, for instance, I'll actually put down for I have my own little notation.
Oh, right.
If that makes sense. So basically, my track name and convention.
Yeah.
Right. So essentially, if I put L-M, I know that it's a mono track panned left.
Ah, right. Yeah.
Or if I go L-25.
Mm-hmm.
-M, I know that it's a mono track that's panned 25% left. And then I'll put in hyphen, and I'll put another hyphen in telling me exactly what that is, what's on there. So it might be a particular character's dialogue within a particular scene. So, for example, it might be... So the tracks might be labelled something along the lines of L25, -M, -Sophie, -Eagle and Child, etc., etc. And so I know that what's on that track is all the right ambience for that particular scene and that location as well. So
right.
Just even by looking at the track, I can tell exactly what it is, whereabouts it fits in the mix, where it comes in into the storyline, etc., etc. And I do the same thing with my music as well. So I had a pipe dream a few years ago where as you're aware yourself, maybe not necessarily many of your listeners, though, I'm hugely inspired by the Radiophonic Workshop.
Yeah.
And what they did in terms of just pushing the boundaries back in terms of what is actually physically possible with audio. I'm also a huge fan of electronic music as well. And personally, I consider the original Delia Derbyshire Doctor Who theme as being at the very, very highest level of the electronic music circuit. It's just, it really is. It's so impressive in terms of how it was made and how it was put together.
Yeah.
And I had this pipe dream for like 25 years that I always wanted to work on a version of the Doctor Who theme with somebody that was actually at the Radiophonic Workshop that actually worked there.
Mm.
And, you know, my good friend G. Ellington Lee, who kind of came in and made contact with me sort of a good sort of 10 years ago, and you know, I actually managed to achieve that, and so it's out there now.
Wow.
And it was quite impressive, to say the least. I mean, I shook for 3 or 4 days when I got Jay's pieces and his recordings, because we did this remotely, because he was out in Arizona and I was out in the UK.
Yeah.
So he sent me all of his takes across, and he did so many different versions of the takes with different instrumentation on them and stuff, so I could pick and choose. But I shook like a leaf. It took me something close to 3 or 4 days before I could stop shaking enough and calm down enough to actually listen to the tracks.
Wow. Oh, that's an amazing experience.
It was. It was absolutely... I was thrilled to bits to have been able to do it. And it's actually the Broken Sea Doctor Who theme now, and it has been for quite some time. And so that was a real honour and a real privilege. Mm. But you can imagine that when I got those tracks across from Jay, what I did was within my production mix, I actually put in every one of his takes within the production mix. Even the ones that I didn't use were there in the mix.
Right.
So I could mute out the ones I didn't want and things like that. So I could just flick between them and say, well, actually, you could probably do with a touch of, I don't know, a touch more vibrato. Right, there's a take there that's already got vibrato on it, so I'll just use that one. And things like that. So it helped me to sort of just filter down and actually select what I needed or what I wanted for the piece. And Jay being Jay, he didn't come on his own either. he actually got a Grammy Award winning saxophonist to actually play the main melody for us.
Fantastic.
So that was quite amazing as well. So we put that together. And then recently I actually went to see the Radiophonic Workshop live, perform live at a theatre that's about half an hour away from where I live. And after the show, I was really surprised to sort of see them all just standing around chatting to people. And they were so approachable. And normally I'm not, how can I put it? I don't normally get very nervous when I talk to famous people very much. Particularly, I mean, years back when I was working in the recording studio, I was working with the likes of the Drifters and Chris Rea and people like that. And I never ever got nervous because I wasn't a particularly big fan of what they do. But, you know, it's just another job, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when you're face to face with people that you actually, you know, are a big fan of, it's a totally different kettle of fish, and you do get quite nervous, and I did as well. And it was like, I honestly didn't know what to say. So basically, what I did was I said, "Look, you know, thanks very much for all of your inspiration. You know, you've inspired me, and I've moved on to do lots of different things myself. In fact, I've just signed a recording contract."
Oh.
For a production company that writes music for films and video games and TV shows and stuff.
Cool.
So, you know, I thanked him and I said, you know, if it wasn't for your inspiration, I wouldn't be where I am now, you know.
Mm.
And there were such lovely people because basically what they did was they came back to me and said, well, okay, what did we inspire you to do? And they were more interested in listening to what I had to say than... And it was so humble, you know, it was so beautiful, lovely experience, you know, and they were way more than what I expected.
Yeah.
And when I was telling you about the, you know, the Doctor Who, original Delia Derbyshire, well, Dick Mills was there. He was the engineer on set in the studio with Delia when she was recording it.
Yeah.
And chatting to Dick Mills about it, it was unbelievable. I mean, he was telling me about there was no keyboards at the Radiophonic Workshop. Nothing, not until later. They came later.
Mm.
So keyboard instruments weren't there. So essentially what they did was Delia generated little tones, electronic tones, and then spliced it all together with bits of sticky tape. So apparently she had this like almost like a photography lab type setup where there was like a little rails hanging down from the ceiling. She had little pieces of tape sort of like stuck on there with pegs, clothes pegs and things.
And I guess she was using, because she had a mathematical background, didn't she, as well as musical, I think.
Yeah.
And so I guess she was actually using the maths in how long each of those pieces of tape were to get the length of the notes right. And it just sounds astonishingly detailed.
And it was incredibly complex because, of course, she wound up with this, for each track, and I think, obviously, you've got a bass line, so that all had to be spliced together. Then you have the melody, which also had to be spliced together. And then you had all of the little, I think Dick Mills described it as glitter, which is all of the little sort of like whooshes and stuff like that that are going on in the background, the sort of sound effects. There was a track for that. That all had to be spliced together manually with pieces of sellotape. And then he was telling us that obviously when they came to put the three reels together to record it as one finished piece, it didn't line up properly because there was a bum note. There was one note out of sequence somewhere and they couldn't figure out which one it was or on which track.
Oh, no.
So
what did they do?
Well, Dick Mills was telling us, he said the Delia wanted to listen to it all together.
Mm.
And she wanted to sit down and listen to all the tracks and see if she could figure it out just by listening to it. And, you know, Dick Mills kind of said, well, you'll never find it if you do that. He says, come on. So he took her down to the canteen at Maida Vale and they went and had a coffee together. And then they came back to it, obviously. You know, I mean, you would, wouldn't you? You would take a break. I know I would if I was in that situation. I'd just walk away from it until I figure it all out, you know. And then when they came back, they actually laid the tape strips all the way down, out of the studio, down a corridor and all the way around. It wrapped around there was a circular bin at the end of one of the corridors. And I think they wrapped it around there as a makeshift tape spool and all sorts until I could visually spot where the bum note was.
Right.
So apparently it took them all night to get it sorted. So, and that was absolutely extraordinary, you know.
Mm.
But that's the type of detail and that's what really inspires me. You know, it's like let's get this done in a really odd, unusual, creative way. Let's, you know, because they didn't have a budget or anything. You know, they had very, very little in the way of sort of finances coming into the Radiophonic Workshop. Yeah. So it's like everything else at the BBC. The TV series Doctor Who had nothing in the way of a budget either. You know, and so they were having to like steal musical instruments and having to make something from nothing.
Yeah.
And that's essentially what I've tried to do over the years as well. So some of the things I've done, like I guess in the past, which some people might consider to be experimental, but I don't. I just think it's kind of just using what you've got. I mean, when I was talking to Jay, my friend Jay, he was telling us that there was one day that they got a call in at the Radiophonic Workshop and they essentially wanted some fire crackling sounds. And so Delia took the cellophane wrapper off a piece of cigarettes and just crumpled it in front of a microphone. And there you go, instant fire crackling.
Brilliant. So, and in a way, do you think that leads to more creativity, the tighter the budget? Because obviously a lot of the listeners, you know, working on audio drama out there, we're doing it in our spare time rather than as a sort of primary paid job or whatever. It can actually help the end project.
I do, yeah. I do, as a matter of fact. And in fact, one of the things I do is when I produce like an episode of Maudlin or I produce an episode of Doctor Who, for each episode I create a whole sound bank of brand spanking new sound effects. And I create those that are only ever used on that one episode of that one series. And then when I've finished, I delete them all.
Do you?
I do. And I've had a number of people come back to me sort of saying, oh, that sound effect you did for that, it's brilliant. Can I have a copy of it? I said, well, I can't. I've deleted it. and that's one of the reasons why I delete it, is first and foremost, it means that those sound effects aren't going to get reused.
Yeah.
It forces me to be more creative. It forces me to create a whole series of new ones for the next episode and the next episode again and the next one again. So, yeah, I do. I delete them all, barring one of them, which is obviously the modelling, like the rift sound. Obviously, it's a constant in the show. And so that has to stay within the mix.
That's interesting. A friend of mine was an artist and he was told a story in one art school. There was a tutor there that as soon as someone was offered a place, they would take their sort of A-level artwork that they'd put together and they would say, OK, I need you now to stamp on it, destroy the whole lot in front of me. And it was a lesson in, I mean, I don't know how true it was, but it was meant to be this lesson in basically letting go and trusting that the creativity would come again from you inside rather than holding on to something you did last year or whatever.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. So, I mean, there was a little while ago, Paul Mannering actually sent me an email, and he was saying that, you know, writing a script, he was talking about what it's like to write a script that he knows is going to be produced by me. And he says basically he can pretty much write anything he wants because he knows that I can recreate it in audio. And so he said, you know, he said, if I wrote a scene where there was a guy walking across 1,000 eggshells that were hatching on a beach whilst a piano is bombed from above.
I want to hear this radio play. It sounds great, yeah.
He said, so if I wrote a scene with that in it, he said, I know I'd get exactly that. And so essentially, just as a bit of a laugh, I actually made that sound effect and sent it to him. There's 1,000 eggshells on a beach, all cracking, and the piano playing, and a bomb comes down and blows the whole beach up.
Fantastic.
So, I nicknamed it the Mannering effect.
So, I'd ask you to share that, but obviously you've deleted it now.
Actually, that one I might have because it was never used on a show or anything. It was just done for a bit of a giggle, you know. So I might still have that one, but yeah, a lot of the sound effects that I create for the shows, I just delete them out because it forces me to be more creative the next time round and to come up with something else and something else. I mean, I suppose it's different if you've got if you've got a story arc that's going across multiple episodes, then you have to retain the sound effects for a few episodes until that story, you know, so you can finish the story, of course, you know. But yeah, I do that all the time, and I did that with Electric Grasshopper as well. Pretty much most of the sounds that I created for that, I've actually removed. I don't any longer have them.
Right. Oh.
And it's purely because I want to, you know, like I say, next time I write a piece of music, I want it to be new, unique, fresh, different. I want it to come from a different area of me, a different part of me. So basically, that's why I do it. And like I said, I've been asked quite a few times. I've had to disappoint a fair few people because I just don't have them anymore, you know. Yeah.
But that's a great ethos. I like that. It's cool.
Yeah. So we do that quite a lot. It's also things like little musical passages as well that I write. I mean, a lot of people don't realise this, but certainly with Maudlin even and Doctor Who, I write a lot of the music that goes onto those shows.
Oh, right.
I don't actually credit myself for musical scores because I consider it to be part of the overall production process. So a lot of those little musical segments I don't any longer have either. I wrote them for that episode and that's it. They were only ever used on that episode and that's it. They're gone now. I mean, there's things like there's certain sound effects, like say, for example, for Maudlin, for example, that I have to keep and retain. And one of which is the cash register in The Eagle and Child and the doorbell sounds, because that's a sound that comes up on numerous episodes.
Yeah.
You've got to use the same one, otherwise you've got no...
You've changed your doorbell again. Yeah, every week.
Yeah.
We just like the look of them.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So you do. I do have a collection of bits and pieces that I have to keep and retain. But yeah, I prefer to sort of do it the other way. I prefer to sort of remove a lot of sounds and create new ones afresh. One of the most interesting ones I got asked to do was The Prisoner TV series. There was a radio play that Broken Sea put out.
Yeah.
And I was asked if I could recreate the Rover sound.
Oh, wow.
The sound effect for the Rover for that. And that was really, really good fun to do because I had to take apart the original sound effect. Now, I got a copy of the original sound effect and I tried to figure out what each individual section is, because it's built up of different layers. It's not just like one recording, there's different layers. And so at least one of the layers is a lion roaring. And that's actually underneath. It's quite low down in the mix, and it's got quite a lot of bass on it as well. So I had to find a lion roaring sound and put that in and sort of build it up and build it up and build it up till I got something that sounded a lot like the original, but also sounded fresh as well. And so what I did was, obviously the original sound effect was a mono recording, and I'm kind of known for pushing the stereo field a lot. Within my works. So basically, when I put this Rover sound effect together, what I did was I had some of the layers where I expanded the stereo image. I had some layers where it was panning from left and right. And then I had other layers that are panned left, panned right at different stages and different percentages left and right. And so it built up and gave you this huge spread of a sound that spread right away across the stereo field. I did it again actually recently with like on our Doctor Who series. There was a sound effect I was asked that I needed to create, or at least a voice effect for a new version of a Cyberman. And this particular Cyberman can actually release his own, I suppose his spirit, I guess, you know, and whatever it is that makes the Cyberman, he can release that and actually broadcast himself into other cyber units.
Cool.
So he can take over the bodies of any other cyber units. But obviously when he's speaking normally, he's speaking like, and the way it was described in the script was like almost having like 100 different voices, like he was built up of multiple personalities. And so to try and get that sound for the voice, I did a similar thing. What I did was Paul Mannering actually voiced that particular character. So what we did was I did different, I took Paul's take, and what I did was I detuned him.
Right.
By different semitones and stuff. So I'd take his pitch down by a couple of semitones, and then down another two, and down another two, and down another. And then I put that at different stages in the stereo. So it all sounds like the same voice, but it's at different pitches and different tones and different positions in the stereo field. So when he's talking, although it sounds like almost like a 100 different versions of him talking.
Wow, that's great. That's great. And do you find, because obviously with you're mentioning Maudlin and Escape from New York and so on, had dialogue compared with Electric Grasshopper without, did you prefer working one way or the other? Or presumably the way you work with dialogue anyway is bringing quite a lot of those multiple effects and depth and so on into it too.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say I preferred one way or the other, to be honest. They were just different. And I wanted, with Electric Grasshopper, I just wanted to do something different rather than, how can I put it? I just wanted to try and do something a little bit unique that not very many people had tried or even attempted to have done before, you know. Other than people like, I guess, Gustav Holst with the Planet Suite. Mm. If you think about what he did with that, it's not a far cry from what I did, to be honest with you, because what he did was he saw the planets and he thought they've all got their own unique personality, and then he worked from that. You know, so Mars the Warbringer, it's a very powerful, dramatic sounding piece of music.
Mm.
So, you know, and Jupiter, was it the planet of jollity?
Yeah.
And you know, and that's kind of almost an amusing sort of piece, you know. And it's, you know, what I did was I just did that with sounds, whereas he did it more with the music. I did it more with sounds. The music for me was more of a backdrop for the sounds, whereas for him, he was creating the different moods with the music. But it's not really a far cry from what I did, to be honest with you. You know, when you consider it along those lines. And no, like I said, I mean, I don't prefer one method or the other. It's just basically, it was just something different. It was just something that I wanted to do that not many other people had done before. It's the same with, I guess, with some of the radio plays I do as well. Occasionally I'll actually mix a scene down in 5.1 surround sound, just purely because not many people are doing it. Then I'll actually condense that down to stereo. And I got really, the first time I tried it, I got really surprised as to how little I actually lost in terms of the space in the mix.
That's interesting, yeah.
So, you know, you do tend to, you retain a lot of that space, even though you've sort of mixed it for five speakers. When you condense it down for two speakers, it's surprising how much of that stays in place. And it almost emulates 5.1 surround sound, but with only two speakers.
That's interesting to know, because I know quite a lot of producers now are experimenting with binaural productions, and it's fascinating kind of how it works sort of in the space when you're listening to those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the first time I went to see the Radiophonic Workshop play live, they actually played in the Queen Elizabeth Hall in London, and they were using a 9.1 surround sound rig for their music, which was, I mean, there were sounds just coming from all around this theatre. It was one of the most impressive things I've ever heard, you know. So I'd love to do more of that, basically. I mean, I've even talked about releasing not just music, but radio players as well, actually with a 5.1 mix.
Cool.
And a stereo mix, of course, for people who don't have a surround sound rig and things, you know.
Of course, yeah.
But so I've talked about doing that as well in the past. And as far as I'm aware, there's only really Dirk Maggs who's actually done that.
Oh, that sounds great. Yeah, I was going to ask, do you have any future ambitions and plans, you know, to...
Yeah, I've got quite a lot. I mean, I've got pretty much a whole season of Maudlin to complete.
Hooray.
I've got at least half a season of Doctor Who to finish off. Mm-hmm. I've got another series of Escape from New York to do. I've just, like I said, just not long back signed a recording contract.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got that to work on as well.
So you're pretty busy for a while.
I am, yeah. And one of the other things I'm doing as well is my friend Jay passed away not long after I went to visit him. And there were two albums that we were working on. One of which will no longer happen, unfortunately, because without Jay's creative force in it, it just doesn't feel right to me to do anything with it.
Yeah.
But the other one was, it was an old solo album that he actually released many, many moons ago. And this is where it all ties in with Electric Grasshopper, actually. And Jay said to me before he died that he really wanted it to be released, because up on his studio wall was a review from an Italian record collector magazine, which basically said... The reviewer actually said that he heard some of the audio, but he didn't believe that the actual album actually existed. So, you know, I can quite happily sit there and turn around to people and say, look, I've got two vinyl copies of this album sat in my studio right now. You can rest assured it exists. But he wanted it. He always felt that the album was incomplete.
Right.
And so what he wanted to do was the whole album to be, to essentially for me to take what he had already done and then add to it to finish it and make it more, sort of bring it up to date and then re-release it again.
Right.
So what I'm going to do is, because I've got all of Jay's parts, even though he's passed away now, I've got all of Jay's parts and I actually own copyright on that album as well. So basically what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to finish the album off and I'm going to release it with all of the proceeds going to a cancer charity.
Oh, that's a really nice thing to do in his honour.
Well, it is. And I also want his name to be out there and to stay out there, you know, because the guy was just an amazing bloke to talk to and to work with. So I'm going to be doing that. And it's going to be very, very similar to what I did with Electric Grasshopper, but... way beyond what I did with Electric Grasshopper, put it that way.
Cool.
The first track on the album's called The Race, and so I've already finished the track, and it sounds like it initially starts off with, again, each track, I mean, this is what Jay actually wanted me to do. He wanted me to do what I did with Electric Grasshopper, but do it with his album. So essentially he wants each piece to tell a story from a drama point of view. So The Race, it starts off with somebody walking across to a car, opening the car door, getting in the car, starting the engine in and absolutely tearing it off. So I always imagined that in this particular piece, that it was kind of about a person that, I mean, this is what I got just purely from hearing just the music. This is what I got from hearing the track was... I kind of like made up a whole story or a backline story of a guy that just all he cared about is driving fast, didn't care who he hurt in the process or anything, and that's what I've tried to mix this track down as. So it kind of tells a story of him getting in a car and charging, and he gets chased by the police, and there's helicopters flying after him and things like that.
So that sounds great.
So that's what I'm doing now. I've finished about the first three tracks for it. So
if Yorkshire Police... find someone. Yeah. I'm sorry, I was only speeding officer because I was trying to get these sound effects. I do the new for every project, you know.
Yeah, well, that's it, yeah. And I needed a unique sound effect that's never been used before.
So if you could get your helicopters out, I'd be so grateful, yeah.
Yeah, so that's where I'm going with that. So I'm doing something along those lines, but on a much bigger scale.
That sounds amazing.
One of the other things as well is I'm actually already in touch as well with the original producer of that album.
Oh.
He contacted me a little while back. And we're kind of talking as well. So it might even be possible for me to get it mastered down in his studio. So again, I'll be taking it back to its source again, which would be really, really great to be able to do. So yeah, I've got quite a lot of this stuff coming up at the moment. I've had a few issues with medical things and stuff going on for the last couple of years that have kind of kept me away from doing what I love doing.
Yeah.
If that makes sense, but those things are starting to subside a little now, so I'm looking very strongly at sort of hitting things quite hard early this year.
Brilliant.
So that'd be good. And obviously modelling will be a big part of that, of course.
Fantastic.
Because it's just one of those shows that I just love doing.
Yeah.
It's a real honour, and the cast on that show are fantastic. Every single member of the cast is just brilliant.
Oh, it's a brilliant show. It's a really, and so well written, and it's just, yeah.
Well, for me, it's like family.
Yeah.
That's how it feels to be working with the cast and working with Alexa. It's like it's just being a part of this other family, and it's just a lovely, lovely thing. So I'll definitely be looking at that as well.
Great. You have a blog, Arid Ice, with Jay Ellington Lee, where you do talk about what you did.
I have, yeah.
Did and are doing, yeah.
And there's a piece there, there's actually a piece on Arid Ice as well, of Jay and I just jamming in Jay's studio together as well.
That's lovely.
So it was a great fun thing to do. Well, one of the things I did was, when I was out in Arizona, my friend Jay, I've been a big fan of electronic music for a very, very long time. And one of the things I've always wanted to do, ever since I seen my first one, was I always wanted to play a theremin.
Wow.
And it's just one of those pieces of musical equipment. It doesn't require a keyboard. It's a completely odd, peculiar way of controlling things. And so I always wanted to do that. And so essentially what Jay did was, when I was out there, he actually took a really modern-day synthesizer and plugged it into a theremin. So I'm triggering this modern-day synthesizer, but with a theremin. And it was just such an unusual sound. And then we went beyond that again. And Jay was one of the inventors on a piece of equipment called a G2M, which is essentially, it's an analog-to-MIDI converter. Now, MIDI is musical instrument digital interface. It's basically what, it's how electronic musical instruments talk to each other nowadays. So, for example, if you have two synthesizers, you can chain them together. So when you press one note, you're triggering both synthesizers to play.
Right.
Right. Well, Jay did an analog to MIDI converter. And essentially what you can do is you can plug in any sound source known to man, and it'll put out a MIDI signal based on that sound source. So essentially, you can plug a microphone in, and you can sing into a microphone, and it'll trigger this synthesizer. And the synthesizer, if you're singing, for example, the synthesizer will follow what you're singing. And so that's something that I really want to play with a lot more, because I have one of these in my studio now.
Cool. With a theremin still, or?
No, I don't have a theremin. I can't afford a theremin.
I know. I had a look at them. There is a film, Frank, with Maggie Gyllenhaal playing a theremin in that. And, she actually learnt to play it, I think. And it's just amazing. Wow. And I've also been, it's been a real ambition of mine as well to try and play one. But then I had a look at how much they were, and it's been put off a little while.
I think the Jay had a Moog one,
right?
And it was something like $3,000.
Yeah,
you know, but you can buy theremin kits, which are a lot cheaper. But you're still sort of soaking £500-600 just for a kit.
Yeah.
You know, and then you've got to build it yourself, of course, as well. So you have to know how to solder and things like this. You know. I'm sort of looking maybe perhaps at doing a few collaborations musically as well, just to see how things go on that as well, just for fun. It's just to try and take me in different directions. you know, that I wouldn't ordinarily go in. I've got an old friend of mine who was the keyboard player for Nazareth in the 70s, and he lives fairly local to me, and we just made touch. We just kind of caught up with each other again recently, and I hadn't actually spoken to him for about 15 years, and he created a Facebook page completely out of the blue. So I tracked him down. You know, I said, "Where are you?" He said, "Well, I'm still living in the same place I was 15 years ago." Oh, no! You know, anyhow, we've just made touch again. We've been catching up. We've had a few sort of jamming sessions as well.
Cool.
And he tends to play a lot of blues and jazz. So it'll be interesting to see how you could figure in sort of electronic instruments into that sort of musical medium.
That would be cool.
Certainly into that sort of genre. You know, and things like that, you know, just lots of little creative, daft little things that I want to do. I mean, I want to do quite a bit more artwork as well. And, you know, just messing around. No doubt my old Roland synthesizer will be out of storage again soon.
Fantastic.
I mean, that one's, I'm 46 years old now, and so is my synthesizer. Honestly, I've actually looked at the production dates for that particular synth, and it literally is within a month of when I was born.
Oh, wow. It's like the song My Grandfather's Clock, but it's my grandfather's synthesizer.
And it still works. It works perfectly, and it's beautiful. It's such an amazing, you can create such amazing sort of sounds with it. And I mean, that's essentially what I'll be using it for, is to create sounds. But I love doing that. I'm probably going to be out and about recording, doing a lot of field recordings as well.
Oh, right, that's cool.
Because I know certainly for the radio players I do, obviously they require certain background ambiences, which are all multiple levels, as I've mentioned before, you know. So, for example, if you were taking a street scene, for example, you'd probably have wind running down the street, which is possibly blowing rubbish and things like that, litter and things like that. And then you've got people walking past, you've got cars going past, you know. So obviously to build up the background ambience, it's lots of multiple layers. And to get something that sounds believable.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it'd be interesting to go and get some authentic sort of recordings of places that I want to go to. And there's one place I'd like to record inside, and that's York Minster.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah.
Which is just an absolutely fabulous, fabulous, fabulous building. It's for anyone that's not been in York Minster, it is this huge cathedral. It looks impressive from the outside, but when you walk inside, the way the light and everything just dances off everything, it's just absolutely massively impressive. And it has its own unique ambience, and I'd love to record that ambience. Again, I'm sort of looking at the sort of 5.1 mixes and things like that as well. Like, seriously considering releasing something as a 5.1 mix. Because I've always prided myself in trying to put the listener right in the centre of the story, or in the centre of it. So whatever's going on is going on around the listener. And so I imagine people a bit further away, standing a bit further back there, a little bit quieter in the mix. I imagine people over to the left, over to the right, people behind you. You know, so 5.1 would work really, really well. Mm. You know, certainly for radio drama, provided that, you know, your listeners have got 5.1 speaker systems and stuff.
Of course.
But again, I'd probably release that anyway as a stereo mix anyway. So, you know, but it would just be interesting. I'd love to do the same with music as well, because like I said, I know that the Radiophonic Workshop have been doing it for a little while. And it'd be interesting to see what happens with Delia's stuff.
Is it a very stupid question to ask, but with a 5.1 mix, do you achieve that through the actual placing of all of the things on the spectrum, panning them and whatever, or do you actually have to put out a certain number of microphones in certain directions and record simultaneously? Or
my production software Sonar, it actually supports 9.1.
Oh, right.
Surround sound. And you can actually pull in like video files. You know, if you're working on a movie soundtrack, you can pull a video file in, and so you've got that as you, so you can sync things in with the actual video and stuff as well. So the video will play right in the center of the screen, and then you have your audio timeline running from left to right. And what you can do is, most production software, you can sort of, on a particular track, you can sort of pan things to different degrees left and right, or centre pan. But with Sona, once you if you hit it that you want to play, you want to record like a 5.1 mix, you've just got a similar sort of thing. Where do you want it in the mix? And you just move the little faders across.
Right.
So you could say, right, I want it on a, I want it coming from the rear speakers, and I want it 25% right or 33% left or whatever. Yeah. So it's just as easy as doing it's just as straightforward as doing a stereo mix. It's not that much more, it's not that much different. It's just that it's a slightly different set of rules.
Yeah.
As to how to do it properly.
Right.
So, but it's interesting though to figure that out. I'd love to sort of do more with that and really truly surround people with sound. It would work really well for music.
Mm.
So, I'm thinking that, you know, should be a good idea. I know that Jean-Michel Jarre released an album called Aero.
Mm-hmm.
And Aero was released... If you bought the CD, you could get the 5.1 CD.
Oh, wow.
And it came with a 5.1 CD that you can actually put into your DVD player. And then it came with, like, the stereo mix as well. So you've got both versions of it. So, you know, I'd like to do sort of similar things, but sort of just make them available for download.
Cool.
And stuff. So, yeah, a lot in the pipeline, but...
That is brilliant. Well, thank you so much for your time chatting today. It was brilliant to catch up with you as well. And...
Oh, it's excellent. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. And all the very best in all your projects.
And to you too.
Cheers. Thanks.
Oh, thanks very much. Bye-bye now.
Wow, Fiona, that he's so cool. He's done so many cool and amazing things. And it's something that I've not really listened to, being honest, myself. Mm. So, I think all his Doctor Who connections and all those kind of things would have pricked up people's ears who are obviously massive fans of those kind of programmes.
Definitely.
It sounds really exciting.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, it's interesting, and it's bringing it into this kind of modern age, isn't it, from where it kind of sat how many decades ago,
yeah.
I guess, as well, with the availability, as you said before, of the amount of sound effects and things that can be created, by experimenting with your own kit. And
totally, yeah. Because we're all using DAWs. You know, the free ones now come with so much that, you know, would have taken a sort of tumble dryer and six rounds of tape to record, you know, before.
Well, you've led an exciting life, Fiona.
Yes. That was a bit before my time, I do hasten to add. But anyway.
That's exciting.
Absolutely. If you want to feedback about that or indeed anything else, please do contact us at podcast@audiodramaproduction.com.
Fantastic. And we have to also let you know of something exciting that's been reviewed on the podcasthost.com site. Well, and for those of you that love recording, I use a Focusrite Scarlett 2i2, but there is currently a Focusrite Scarlett 18i8 available, which has been beautifully reviewed on the podcast host site by Matthew and Co. So key things about it seems are that instead of just a couple of mics, you can plug in up to four XLR mics instead of one or two and record at least 3 to 8 people at a time then on separate tracks. I don't know if you want to add anything onto that.
No, I think Matthew covers it very well indeed. I think, for people wanting to use actors in a studio environment, it would be fantastic. Yeah.
So run on over there and have a little check out of that fun equipment if it's something you want to do.
That's it. That's at www.thepodcasthost.com. And we're putting a link to Matthew's article in our show notes.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it only remains for us to say a massive thank you for supporting the show, and especially to our Patreons, Fiona.
Yes, thank you so much. Your funding goes to help keeping this show going. And if you feel like contributing and you do have the opportunity to, then please do visit our Patreon site. There are details on the show notes.
Marvellous. Well, thank you very much to Stevie K. Farnaby for his time and expertise. And we look forward to speaking to you again in a couple of weeks' time.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Bye for now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.